Hey, welcome to a new episode of Skin in the Game. This is your host, John Semperman, with my co-host,
Tim Elshai from the Buffalo News.
Hey, Tim, how are you today?
I am good. We missed you last week. I did a baseball episode without you.
By the way, I did listen, and great job, and great conversations with a number of very interesting and talented guests.
We had a great summer talking baseball, and I don't think we're done. I'm sure we'll be talking a bit more baseball. We're heading into my favorite season, fall. Football is starting up in a few days. Hockey's right behind that. Basketball's, you know, right up
busy,
there too.
Busy time of year.
My favorite time.
Yeah. Really excited on the program today. We have Ryan Creelan. Ryan is the commissioner of the ECHL, which is really the AA affiliate kind of level. So you've got the NHL, you've got the American Hockey League, and now the E, which is a really great feeder and affiliate program for the National Hockey League.
And they're running a really interesting league, John. It's, first of all, it's not just the East Coast Hockey League anymore. We're going to get more into that. But they've got 30 teams, soon to be 32, and they're required to keep pace with the NHL. In other words, they cannot have more teams in the ECHL than the NHL does in their league. But if the NHL happens to expand more, the ECHL has got some more cities in mind. So it's a league that is growing. It is vast. It is diverse. And I'm really interested to dig deep into that with the guy who runs it.
So before we get to Ryan, just a couple of news items. And I think the first one, which we haven't talked about on this program yet, which is a development out of Rochester with new ownership of the indoor lacrosse team, the Nighthawks.
Yeah, the Seneca Nation of Indians, which is, you know, run by President J.C. Seneca, stepped in to purchase the Nighthawks. The Pegula family, who owned the Buffalo Bills, of course, and the Buffalo Sabres and lacrosse's Buffalo Bandits, also had the Nighthawks and decided to step away from owning that franchise. And the Seneca Nation stepped right in, which is an incredible story. And it's a story that made national news.
I think it's a great move, Tim. I think, first of all, as we talked about with S.L. Price, maybe four or five episodes back, you know, obviously the history and the legacy of the sport is, you know, Seneca Nation is Native American. And so to me, it's really kind of the authenticity of that investment makes sense. I know there's a real passion among the new ownership group for the sport and to grow the sport.
Lacrosse is the original ball and stick sport. It was, you know, its roots go back well over the centuries, I think 1,000 years or more, back to indigenous communities who played the sport not only for sport, but for much, you know, deeper cultural, you know, connected reasons. And you can listen back to that episode and read Scott's book, read S.L. Price's book to learn more about what happened with the sport of lacrosse and how it's changed over the years in terms of how it is treated, right, by different corners of the sporting world. But to see, suffice it to say, to see the Seneca Nation step in and take ownership of a team in a sport that is so very close to their people is just incredible. So that is, it's a rare sports story that just brought a true warm smile mm-hmm. to me when I saw it.
These communities, these Native American communities, are looking at this as an investment, as an ROI. And I think part of that is, you know, there's been some erosion of their gaming business. You know, online betting has not helped brick and mortar casinos. So these communities need to look at ways to diversify their holdings, and I think you're going to see more investment in professional sports.
I think it's safe to say there are a few investments that are more assured of getting, you know, if you can do it, of bringing you a profit than a pro sports team.
Yeah.
If you can put the money in and if you can be patient. If you're looking for a quick buck, no.
Right. And it's not as much in the short term the profit. It's the appreciation value of the asset. So, you know, there are a lot of major league teams that don't make money year to year, but they still 5, 10, 15%, the value of that team continue to just go up. So you have to have the capital to get into the game. and a little bit of that liquidity to make sure you can fund some down years. But overall, it's only going one way, and that's up. So let's keep our eye on that. And hopefully in an upcoming episode of Skin in the Game, we'll get some representation from the new ownership of the Nighthawks and kind of dig a little bit deeper on why that investment and where they hope to go with it.
Oh, sure thing. Would love to sit down and talk with them.
Right. Before we get to our guest, there's some really hot U.S. Open news. It is the Honey Deuce.
That is where I thought you were going with
which
this.
Is the Grey Goose Lemonade Raspberry Liqueur Drink that for $23, Tim, you can have that in a collectible cup. And here's why I bring this up. We say this in, you know, kind of in jest, but there is a business perspective here, right?
No, this is a big deal. I take this seriously.
Let me give you a couple of quick numbers. They sell 550,000 of these drinks during the U.S. Open. That's number one. That's 1.5 seconds. They're pouring a new Honey Deuce. 1.5 seconds. And revenue-wise, this drink, Grey Goose, Lemonade, Raspberry Liqueur, generates $12 million in revenue for the venue of the U.S. Open, that being Arthur Ashe Stadium.
I have a bar at home. I can make this thing. I'm sure it tastes different at the U.S. Open, and I'm sure it tastes different. But, I mean, good for them. That's great. And what it is, it's great marketing. I'm sure it's fantastic mixology.
Sure.
Really, it's incredible marketing. And, I mean, that drink went viral on social media.
You had Serena Williams tried one. She liked it. Okay. Big boxes checked there, Instagram. And then, of course, what fad wouldn't begin, what trend wouldn't start without Travis and Taylor were also seen having the Honey Deuce.
Yes, I believe I was there when they had it, which made me further regret not buying one myself. However, congratulations to Travis and Taylor on their engagement. One other big piece of, I guess, sports and entertainment.
It's definitely cultural news, and I'm sure that the Honey Deuce will be on the reception menu. So.
Yes, we clink a Honey Deuce. Cheers to Travis and Taylor.
So with that, we're going to get back to the other business.
This is
sports.
A hard segue to the ECHL, but here we go.
Yeah, but I want to welcome up coming right up after the break, Rylan Creelan, who is the commissioner of the ECHL. We're going to talk all about minor league hockey and where that league is and where that league is going. So stay tuned.
I'm excited to see, like, she said this, well, he said that.
The truth will come out.
Wondering what the buzz is? What's the hot goss? Whatever it is, we're talking about it on Group Chat, your weekly connection to the unpredictable, weird, and wonderful world of pop culture. From film, music, theater to food, blockbusters, and beyond. Every week with Tiffany Bentley and her revolving panel of pop culture enthusiasts. Listen to Group Chat on Fridays at 10 a.m. and Saturdays at noon on BTPM NPR.
I'm very excited.
Hey, welcome back to Skin in the Game, and we're thrilled to introduce our guest, Rylan Creelan. Rylan is the commissioner of the East Coast Hockey League. Hey, Rylan, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, no, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
You know, we're here in NHL country, right, between Toronto and Buffalo, and I just thought for our listeners, you could just give them a little bit of background on the East Coast Hockey League and kind of that 30,000 foot view.
It starts back in 1988, not with me. I was only 4 years old at that point, but we started with five teams in four states, and over the past 37, 38 years have really worked to try and grow the league and solidify ourselves in hockey's development as well as an entertainment option in our markets. Minor league hockey has changed a lot over those past 38 years. In fact, there were a number of other leagues, notably the West Coast Hockey League and the Central Hockey League that subsequently folded. The ECHL was able to bring those teams at that time into our league to help grow. And that's why we're now at a point here in 25, 26, where we're currently at 30 teams, but we've announced teams number 31 and 32 for the future as well to match the NHL and AHL, and I think really solidify hockey's future and our role in the development of hockey.
Hey, Ryan, it's Tim Elshai. Thank you for joining us. John and I have been excited to get to some hockey talk. You just touched on the point I wanted to ask you about. You know, it's called the East Coast Hockey League, but it is anything, you know, but the East Coast Hockey League anymore. How has that impacted the way the league is run, the quality of players you're able to recruit, the quality of play?
The ability for the league to be that stable league that survived through all that turmoil over the past 2-3 decades has allowed us to grow, make more of a name for the league, allow us to recruit more players, and really show that we are the launching pad for young players to develop their career with upwards aspiration of making it to the AHL and NHL. Of note, we've decided to keep the ECHL name, despite having teams in Tahoe and Boise, Idaho, and again, bringing on some of the teams from that old West Coast Hockey League, because the brand has really matured over those past 37, 38 years. So ECHL no longer stands for East Coast Hockey League. It just stands for ECHL. I know that's hard because human beings want the acronym to stand for something, but people know us as the E. That's known in the hockey community. And so we keep it that way. And I like to make it akin to the Big Ten. I've run out of fingers and toes as to how many teams are actually in that conference. But they're still the Big Ten. And the reason they do it is there's real value in that brand.
Right. Well, and speaking of kind of the brands and the E, again, maybe for our listeners, you know, how do you compare, contrast the ECHL to kind of other development leagues, whether it be the CHL, whether it be the USHL? Kind of where does the E fit in that space?
Yeah, so obviously those leagues are amateur leagues targeted towards 16 to 20-year-olds. I would tell you we're for the players who are developing later, maybe aren't a high draft pick, but may be drafted and then sent down to the ECHL or undrafted, but still looking for that opportunity to play and prove themselves. So they've completed their junior career. They've completed their NCAA eligibility, but still have a lot to give to the game and want to try it out even further. And because of our affiliations with the NHL, AHL, gives them the opportunity to showcase themselves to that group, a lot of scouts watching our league, and potentially work their way up to the next level. Obviously, it's very competitive, a lot of folks going for jobs at the AHL and NHL level, but our league provides that opportunity.
Ryan, I want to talk about the breadth of markets in the league as well. And you've got teams in major markets like Atlanta, big league market like Cincinnati. You are in Jacksonville. You're in Kansas City, Orlando, and a handful of other large markets. But you're also in, you know, as you know, a lot of smaller ones, Kalamazoo, Toledo. You're in Tulsa. I'm wondering how you measure success of a franchise in a smaller to mid-sized market versus one of those very large traditional big league markets.
Yeah, I mean, listen, I actually think success is gauged very similarly across all of those markets, and it's by the amount of attendees we're able to bring into our building. We're a very live entertainment focused product, and getting folks into our building. Now, some of those larger markets have larger buildings, so you could look at capacity percentage. But at the end of the day, we're looking at attendance overall and recognize that each market, whether large or small, has its own challenges. And what I mean by that is a small market, you have a smaller market size or population base to draw from. But odds are you may be the ticket in town, maybe the only professional sports team in town that fans can attend within that local geography. Meanwhile, if you're in one of those large markets, a lot more folks, a lot bigger population to draw from, perhaps a larger building to fill as well. However, you're competing with NFL teams, Major League Baseball teams, so on and so forth. And so it becomes very competitive in the professional sports marketplace. So at the end of the day, again, I try and look at number of folks coming out to the building and capacity percentage.
And Ryan, is there, I know every market's different, but you've recently gone through some, you know, additional expansion markets. Is there a blueprint for what, quote unquote, an ideal ECHL market looks like? You know, are there any, you know, what are some of the metrics that you look at when you look to expand?
Yeah, so there's an easy one to start with, and we need to find venues that have ice. Without ice, we aren't playing hockey. And so you need to start there.
It's a good place.
Certainly, yeah. Modern venues, venues going under construction that have new amenities such as suites, party areas, center hung video boards. Those are all very important to the modern entertainment experience. So we look for that. And when you find a venue that meets those standards, then you've got to look at the actual market in terms of population, demographics. You'll look at traditional versus non-traditional hockey markets, although that doesn't matter as much, especially with the way that we market ourselves and try and promote our business. And then that market's geography is also very important. The ability to create rivalries and limit travel amongst our divisions is a key component. And then the two other pieces that go into expanding and really trying to create a successful ECHL team is ownership and community. So we pride ourselves on being a community asset, being out in the community. We often say it's about the name on the front and not the name on the back. Especially being a developmental league, you've got a lot of player turnover, a lot of coaching turnover, which, listen, that's a good thing when you're a developmental league, but it's about being that community asset. And so we want owners who want to be involved in the community and won't necessarily be afar. You know, they're there supporting their team and then also out interacting with the folks that really allow us to prosper.
That's great. And Tim, I'm looking to you. What kind of drove me reaching out to Ryan for this conversation is a few months back, and Ryan, you're going to appreciate this, spent a couple days in Savannah, Georgia, which is one of my favorite towns. And every little pub or bar or restaurant I stopped into, and there were quite a few I stopped into, there were Savannah Ghost Pirates banners and table tents and coasters just to integrate that kind of community focus of the team. So I think I know what you're talking about there, Ryan, because I think the Ghost Pirates are an example of, I think, doing it right.
Yeah, I mean, in naming the team, a lot of our clubs look to what's local, what will the folks in the market respond to. I thought Ghost Pirate was right on point in Savannah, Georgia, with all the folklore there. And they also came out with a pretty cool color scheme that matched the logo, and merch was wildly successful in that marketplace. And I suppose not just that marketplace, but outside that marketplace as well. I think a lot of folks were drawn to the color scheme and the logo, and it speaks to who Savannah is.
Right, right. No, that was great. And so, you know, kudos to the ownership and the marketing team down there, because they've really done a nice job presenting the brand.
All right, I want to jump in here, John, and ask Ryan about another Georgia team, one of the expansion teams, Augusta, Georgia. I think a lot of our listeners, Ryan, may not know that the famed quarterback, the former Heisman Trophy winner, Tim Tebow, is going to be the owner of that franchise. For those who are not aware, tell them the story of how Tim Tebow came to become an ECHL owner.
So we have a presence down in Florida. We have three teams there now in Fort Myers, Orlando, and Jacksonville. Tim is a Florida native, and through some of those circles, we were able to get connected with him as well as his business partner, David Hodges. And we were able to launch the first team with them out in Tahoe. So going back a couple years with the construction of that new building, we're able to get both David and Tim involved in that project. They just wrapped up year one out there, had a very successful year, both on and off the ice. and they wanted to do more, and I suppose notably do more in the East, back closer to home. And with the revitalization of the arena in Augusta, now it's still 2 years away, but we were able to work with them. They were able to secure the lease, and we were able to announce, I guess, a week or two ago that they will be the 32nd member team in the ECHL starting in the 27-28 season. So this will actually be Tim and David's second team in the ECHL, this one on the East Coast for them. And I know they're looking forward to it. Easier travel for them to get to in the future. And at the press conference, Tim was giving the local Georgia Bulldogs a little bit of a ribbing about his Florida Gators. So looking forward, you know, it's SEC country down there.
Does he have some hockey DNA? Does he have a passion now for the sport?
He definitely has a passion for the sport. I'm not certain he will get on skates, but he definitely has a passion for the sport. And when you hear him talk about it, about the atmosphere and the environment and being up close, he's got a passion for lots of sports, but it's clear that hockey resonates with him.
That's awesome. That's awesome. And actually reading that little bit of background on the new team in Augusta, it sounds like you're going to be partnering up, or at least on the venue side, is Oak View Group. And for our listeners, Peter Luca was on the program, you know, a few months back, and I think they've got a really solid building partner operator as part of that group as well.
No doubt. We've been very fortunate to work with the Oak View Group on a number of different projects, either new buildings or buildings that they may have acquired the management rights to. And they have been a really good partner for hockey in general. They see the value in having a hockey tenant in their building and have worked with us to craft leases that can make it a viable option in the market.
Let me ask you, Ryan, about the other expansion franchise. This one's going to Rio Rancho, New Mexico. Tell us a story of how the ECHL landed on putting a franchise in New Mexico.
First off, Western expansion has been a point of emphasis for a number of years now. And so we've been looking west of the Mississippi to try and find geographies and venues that would fit into our footprint. Knew about the Rio Rancho building. It was built in the early 2000s, had minor professional hockey for a little bit. It needed some time away. Part of the city's growth, though, has been towards the building and the surrounding area. And I visited maybe two and a half years ago, started to lay the framework, and fortunately enough was also introduced to the folks at Rev Entertainment. Those folks are the event operators for the Texas Rangers of Major League Baseball. They were looking to get involved in more sports as well. There was a synergy there. They went out, they loved the opportunity, met with the local politicians and the venue management group. And we were able to bring it all together to announce for next season. So they won't play until 26-27, but that's okay because we wanted to give them the runway. They're also doing some additional development to upgrade the arena and the surrounding area to bring in larger crowds. And that extra lead time will be well worth it as we look to welcome them as team number 31 next season.
That's great. Now, in the case of Savannah as well as New Mexico, do those franchises already have NHL affiliations, or are those still to be determined?
They will be determined. I know they're looking at different options and working on it. Right now, all 30 of our teams will be affiliated. We intend to make that 31 for 31 and 32 for 32 in due time. But things do change as the markets change. I think when I've tried to look back at the history of affiliations, geography is playing a larger part more and more. So as new Western opportunities pop up, I think teams at the NHL, AHL level that are out West would look to affiliate more locally than maybe if they have somebody all the way on the East Coast.
Yeah, I was just, you know, doing some homework here, and it looks like, and correct me if I'm wrong, Toronto Maple Leafs are now aligned with the Cincinnati Cyclones.
Correct.
And the Buffalo Sabres are down south in Jacksonville with the Icemen.
Correct.
Gotcha. And just for our listeners, so when you're following your favorite ECHL team, you know where to look. But with that, with the affiliations, obviously with Major League Baseball, you know, things like player assignments and reassignments and two-way contracts are all connected to that, you know, AA or that AAA affiliate. How does it work in the ECHL?
So it's complicated, but I'll try and distill it down here. So there will be players on NHL contract assigned to our league. There will be players on AHL contract assigned to our league. And those are dictated by your affiliate, right? Which players they want to place in the ECHL for development. And then the balance of your team would be made up of players that are on ECHL contract that are recruited by the local ECHL general manager and coach to fill out the roster. And those players, as they showcase themselves, can maybe catch a scout's eye, catch the affiliate's eye, catch an unaffiliated team's eye, and potentially get signed to an AHL PTO, which is a part-time tryout, or to an AHL SBC, which is a standard player contract. And now they're on AHL contract with the potential to advance to the NHL. It gets a little complicated because you could, this doesn't always happen, but you could have a player who was on ECHL contract, his ECHL rights are with that particular team, and he gets called up to a different affiliate and signs a contract there, but his ECHL rights are with that unaffiliated team. So it's a little wonky. It's not as direct as baseball is. But hey, we make it work.
And you got it. That's definitely, I'm looking at John and smiling here. That's one of those questions where it's like, okay, there's a quiz afterward. Do you find, Ryan, I should ask you this though. Do you find that, you know, fans enjoy, you know, continuity of roster and have a sense of if a guy's called up where he's going and if he might be sent back? You know, traditionally in minor league baseball, people, you know, again, it's fairly linear. People have had a sense of where those guys are going. Do you find that your fans are able to keep track of their favorite players if there's some movement on the roster?
Yeah, I think it really depends on the fan. And what I mean by that is there are certainly some diehards out there, the season ticket holders that come to every game and follow the players throughout. But a large portion, in fact, the greater majority of folks coming to our games may not know the players on the roster, but they're there to support their local team and cheer them on. And maybe they come to two or three games a year, or they bring their family, or they come with their group outing, maybe a church outing. So it all depends on the fan. At the same time, there are diehard minor league hockey fans that may not live close to an ECHL market and never get a chance to step foot inside one of our venues, but they follow every one of our transactions every day. So it really depends on how you define that fan. What we try and pride ourselves is on offering that hometown community spirit, welcoming those group outings, welcoming the families at an affordable price so that folks can come out, spend 2.5 hours and have a night out.
Do you know off the top of your head, what is your smallest market?
Smallest market by true city limits would be Glens Falls, New York. It's the Adirondack Thunder.
I was going to guess that, the Adirondack Thunder. I was like,
true city limits, you're looking at about 15,000 people. When you go out, you start to pick up Albany and some of the Saratoga, some of those other markets surrounding. Then you can get closer to 100,000. The three or four smallest markets in our league would be Glens Falls, New York, Wheeling, West Virginia, Rapid City, South Dakota, and Kalamazoo, Michigan.
Got it. And I would, off the top of my head, save for some college programs that would, they would likely be, those hockey teams would be the only ticket in town, at least by season, right, in those places. I think that's accurate. Whereas, again, in Atlanta or some of the other mega cities, you've got a lot of choices. I'm thinking in a bigger city, the ECHL is providing an incredibly comparatively affordable, you know, professional sports option, right? Whereas in some of those smaller cities, it is that plus also, you know, I could see, and this is what I'm wondering, you know, if those are the cities where you tend to see the fans really embrace the players and follow, you know, follow their moves, like where the guys playing on these teams are the celebrities in town. That's my instinct, but am I on track with that?
Yeah, I do think things have changed as we've become more of a developmental league. And the players move at a more rapid pace, whereas a lot of those markets we just mentioned are very, I'll say, old-time hockey markets that have had professional hockey in a number of different leagues over the years. And so I do think your general thought process is correct. I just think it's changed in the modern environment and hockey's development landscape. Versus, you know, some of those markets like Kalamazoo has had professional hockey for 50 years.
And talking about the arenas that you're looking at in these new markets, we had Amy Shear from the Professional Women's Hockey League on again a few months back, and there's a lot of markets that might make sense for that league, but they're limited with venues because, you know, an 18,000, 20,000 seat venue is just too big, but then some of these college venues at 1,500, 2,000 are too small. Is there an ideal kind of capacity that you're looking for or have found success with?
Yeah, I would say our sweet spot is typically 6,500 to 7,500 seats. We have smaller than that. Our smallest two buildings would be Tahoe and Glens Falls, and Boise's in there as well. They're all between 4,300 and 5,000, but our sweet spot is really around 7. We do play in some large buildings as well. Orlando down in the Kia Center, excuse me. That's an NBA building, but typically we would curtain off the higher end zones and just focus on lower bowl. We do that in a couple other buildings as well. Our building in Tulsa holds 16,000-17,000 folks, and they're able to put in those numbers maybe four times a year. But you know, our average attendance is around 5,000, and so the buildings that are more in that range just really fit our product better.
Yeah, we talk a lot about that size building here on Skin in the Game because, also for other events, again, whether it's women's hockey, whether it's smaller concerts, boutique events that just can't afford or fill up an 18,000 seat building. Boy, that 8,000, 7,500 number is a sweet spot for a lot of events.
No doubt. And think about it too, from an atmosphere perspective. If you can get 5,000-6,000 people into an 8,000 seat building, it's got some life to it. And the atmosphere builds for everybody, the players, the fans, so on and so forth. Whereas if you put 5,000 people in a 20,000 seat building, it feels like a empty cavern.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you brought up atmosphere and I wanted to talk a little bit about atmosphere because I love minor league sports. I love the family environment. I love the creativity of the game entertainment experience, right? Are there things that the ECHL is doing from either an in-game entertainment perspective or rule changes that, you know, might be at some point adopted from, you know, the NHL or the AHL?
Sure. So on the rule change front, we've actually tried to mirror the AHL and NHL on almost everything, with the intent being for gameplay and development of players, coaches, officials. Actually, a lot of our officials bounce back and forth between the ECHL and AHL on a nightly basis. So on Friday, you got one set of rules. On Saturday, you could have a different set of rules. So we've tried to align mostly everything on up the scale for those reasons. I would say notably at the ECHL level, though, we've had 7-minute overtime for a number of years now, and we really enjoy it. What we have heard from players, from fans, that they want to settle the game in a full sheet of ice versus trying to settle it in a shootout. We still have the shootout if the 7 minutes expire, but we have proven, we can show you the numbers, that more games finish in the 7-minute overtime than the 5-minute overtime. I guess it stands to reason, but the numbers bear out. I get a lot of feedback on a lot of different things. And 7-minute overtime, I thought maybe, you know, we would try it for a year or two and it'd be gone. And it is stuck for 5-6 years now.
Interesting.
Beyond the actual game itself, though, I think our teams do an absolutely fantastic job in focusing on entertainment. It's one of the key pillars that we pride ourselves on. And we go way beyond the game in terms of trying to create different intermission activities, different video boards, to engage folks, get them singing together, all sorts of different things so that it's more than just a hockey game. And of particular note, in our league, we've tried to work with third-party entertainment brands to bring in outside brands or outside entertainment. So what do I mean by that? I think I'd be fair to say we started with Nickelodeon and Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. We work with Marvel and DC Comics. So we've had Batman versus Joker on ice. We've had Superman, all the different comic book characters. And we've continued to keep that rolling. We're trying new things here with different Warner Brothers properties. And not only is it a cool jersey on the ice, if you've ever seen some of the jerseys, they're absolutely fantastic. But then the game has an entire theme to it, maybe trivia questions, music, characters walking around the concourse or perhaps getting involved in intermission activities. You could go and if you ever seen Paw Patrol, it's a popular kids cartoon. The line to see the characters is a lot longer than the line to watch the hockey game sometimes, because the kids are just so enthralled with the characters. But our goal there is to welcome new people into the building who may have not been hockey fans and said, oh, you know, I don't like hockey, but oh, my kids like Paw Patrol, I'm going to come out. And we feel that once we get them into the building and they experience the atmosphere, that they can become hockey fans further on down the line. That doesn't mean they're going to be season ticket holders the next night, but maybe it gets them to come back to another game or two and eventually build some affinity for the game.
We're both wondering here if you've partnered, have any of your teams partnered with Mattel? Has there been a Barbie night?
It is in the works.
Good.
We had the game entertainment director for the Toronto Blue Jays on a month or so back, and she was over the top thrilled with the outcome from Barbie night at the Blue Jays.
We will have at least one team doing it this year, maybe two, just working on some of the paperwork, but we're excited to get that launched.
Could that go as far as like pink jerseys, things like that?
Oh, no doubt. Gotta be pink. It's Barbie.
I love where you're going with this entertainment. And I think for a lot of NHL fans, you know, they may have noticed a difference in the last 6, 7, 8 years. Ryan, as you may know, I used to run the marketing for a couple NHL teams, and we used to be able to get so creative around the intermissions, right? Whether it was youth hockey games or other entertainment, and some now of the NHL restrictions is, you know, while it might be a 20-minute intermission, you know, 12 of that minutes, the ice is just setting, right? It really limited what we could do from an entertainment perspective during those breaks. So it's great to see you guys still have that flexibility within the game to really have some fun.
Yeah, and listen, that's what it's all about. It's about fun. And, you know, we take the game very seriously, but within reason. And then we try and have some fun outside of it. We were the first league. We did colored goalposts with our Geico sponsorship. So we had blue goalposts that had Geico branding around them. I'm not certain if you saw what Tahoe did this past year, but with one of their casino partners, the face-off circle was a roulette wheel. And again, within reason, there were some things we needed to tweak to get it right. But we enjoy being nimble. We think it's fun, it's creative, and it's what allows us to help grow our business.
So, you know, what else might be on the horizon for the East Coast Hockey League?
First, we want to formally get to 32. We've announced 32. But a big part of our business in minor league hockey is focusing on stability and trying to make sure that we get to 32 and hold 32. I think we can do that, but maybe there's some more shuffling of the deck here over the next couple years. And the way our charter aligns, as approved by our board, we're allowed to match the NHL. So 32 is the number for now, although I hear all the swirling rumors about them potentially expanding. So perhaps they'll change the goalposts on us and we've got to go get more. So we never stop looking, looking at new building opportunities, looking at new markets. For now, I'm going to catch my breath and say, okay, we've got a plan to 32. It's a very difficult business. It's a fun one, but we're selling a lot of family affordable tickets and we're competing in a very competitive discretionary income market for that entertainment dollar. We're proud of our growth, but we've got to continue to keep the foot on the gas pedal.
Are there markets or even just regions, making this broader, regions of the country where you look and say, yeah, that's a place where hockey, if we could get the right building and the right ownership, that's underutilized in hockey. I mean, hockey could do really, really well there.
Yeah. I've got a couple of places in mind. And in fact, there are some markets where I have talked to prospective owners that would put a team in there tomorrow, but there's no building. And that's probably the biggest challenge regarding expansion is that buildings do not grow up out of the ground. And they certainly don't grow up out of the ground with ice. And so working with public investment, private investment to get these projects funded at the right level for our arena size as well and funded with ice. Again, the costs on a modern facility have just grown exponentially.
There's some modular buildings that are being done for Major League Soccer, you know, USL, that are in that $10 to $12 million range. But the moment you put a roof on it, the moment you add infrastructure for ice, you know, that multiplies by 4 to 5 times. So it's a different animal.
I'm not going to sit here and tell you that I'm in the arena construction business, far from it. But I would tell you some of the more recent projects are probably in the $200 to $300 million range for a 7 to 10,000 seat building.
Ryan, but I got to play journalist here, though. I am a journalist, so I'm not even playing. You said you've got some regions on your radar. I'm going to go on the assumption you won't tell us the cities, but are you willing to let us know the parts of the country that you're thinking about?
I always want to look at the West. There's less opportunities in the West because it's just so expansive out there and the cities are further apart. I do have a focus on the West, notably to help that division with travel. Coming back East, though, I think the region between kind of North Carolina and Pennsylvania is underserved. So you're looking at, you know, that Virginia, Maryland, Delaware region, I think is an opportunity for minor league hockey.
Ryan, I know you'll agree, television does not do the great sport of hockey justice. You need to see it. You need to see the speed, the size, the skill in person, in a building. And then, yeah, you'll graduate up to become a viewer of an NHL game or a viewer of an American Hockey League game. But I think all of that fandom starts in these smaller markets, in these smaller buildings.
Yeah, no doubt. And again, because we pride ourselves on being affordable, it gives everyone an opportunity to come out and experience the game. As you touch on, I do think this is would have been early 2000s, but the expansion of television to HD, I think, helped hockey in that regard. Standard def hockey was painful. HD helped, but nothing, and I mean nothing, compares to the live experience. It just can't be replicated currently through a digital medium.
Great. Well, Ryan, we really appreciate you joining us here today. It's good to be back to talking some hockey here as summer turns into fall. It's not quite fall yet, but we can feel it, and we're excited for the hockey season. Thanks for joining us on Skin in the Game.
Yeah, no doubt. Thank you, guys.
Thanks, Ryan. Look forward to catching up soon.
Don't go away. We'll be right back.
Corey here with the Compact Civics Expansion Pack.
America is such a big, wide, awesome place, and to be able to see things that are representative of so many different places can be so important when brought to your tiny town.
Everybody is so kind and loving. I'm here in Buffalo just because of State Buffalo.
From urban farms to rural fairs, we'll celebrate spaces that bring us together and create community.
Watch on the Buffalo Toronto Public Media YouTube channel.
From your morning commute to quiet evenings at home, Buffalo Toronto Public Media is always there with trusted news, inspiring stories, and timeless music. It's your connection to a world of wonder. This is Public Media.
Hey, welcome back to Skin in the Game, and I want to thank Ryan Creelan from the East Coast Hockey League for joining us on the program today. Tim, great conversation. It was great to touch base with Ryan and get a kind of a perspective on the East Coast Hockey League.
And I learned something right away, which is I think we're not supposed to call it the East Coast Hockey
That's
League.
That's right, anymore. It's the E.
The E. Yeah. Can you think of any other pro sports league out there that has such a diversity of cities? I mean, we've got Glens Falls in the Adirondacks up in New York, you know, all the way over to like a mega megatropolis like Atlanta.
Yeah, just the size of those markets. You know, the only one that comes to mind is the NBA's Development League, the G League, you know, where you have a market like Detroit or Cleveland with a team, and then smaller markets like Sioux Falls, right? So that's probably the only league that I think has such a disparity in size of markets.
You know, and we, as you often say, and I do too, we don't get into a lot of X's and O's or into the player mindset too often on Skin in the Game, though we have. And something that comes to mind for me is imagine being a player or a coach in the E, and, you know, you might be playing in the Adirondacks one night, and then a week later you're playing in Atlanta or in an NBA arena in Orlando. That's got to be a mind-blowing experience to travel around in that league and play, but they've done a great job with it, and up to 32 teams soon. That's impressive.
Yeah, I think it's great. I think, as I alluded to when we wrapped up with Ryan, I think it's just great that they're also exposing this great sport, which really needs to be experienced live to appreciate it, to so many new fans. And a lot of these markets you talked about, Savannah, Augusta, New Mexico, these are non-traditional hockey markets, and I would venture to guess for a lot of those attendees, it's the first time they've experienced the sport. This league, the E, as well as other leagues we talked about, AAA, AA, our friends in Batavia, New York with the Muck Dogs, you know, it's giving fans an option, right? And you and I are both NHL fans, and we love the National Hockey League and the sport and the players, the skill, but you know something? It's also fun to maybe go see a minor league hockey game because it's a completely different experience. Not the game itself, but everything around the game.
Yeah, the energy in those small arenas, you really can't overstate just what it feels like to be in a 5,000 or 10,000 person venue that's full or close to full. And you know, it's a cliche to say the crowd is rocking the ceiling off, but it does feel it, and you do physically feel it.
I had a chance to watch a game with a bunch of buddies of mine. We went up to Eagle River, Wisconsin. This was probably maybe a 2,000 seat ratchety old building, right? The place was packed. 1,500, 2,000 people in a small minor league building was a great experience. A lot different than going and seeing an NHL game, but quality entertainment nonetheless.
Obviously, the guys skating in the NHL are the best in the world. Ice to ice, if you could watch both games side by side, you're going to see the skill difference. But when you're watching, you know, the players in the ECHL who are professional players who are
getting paid to do it.
Yeah. Top notch, you know, players from where they're coming from, and they're getting paid, and they're not getting paid a ton of money. But I mean, this is the core of what they do, right? You're going to see great hockey too. So that's the thing with minor league sports is you're still going to see incredibly competitive sports for the people who really aren't there for the other entertainment. They're there to see, you know, well-played competition.
Right.
You're going to get it.
I'm really glad, though, Tim, to you put on your reporter hat and you dug a little deeper.
Yeah, where are those cities, buddy? Come on.
Where
should John put an expansion team?
You know, so obviously that mid-Atlantic corridor, right? You know, the Richmonds of the world, right? You know, I think Pacific Northwest is ripe. And, you know, there is some talk about the National Hockey League looking at a Portland, for example, and take a look at how well the game of hockey has done in Seattle with the Kraken. So I think there's fertile ground in that Pacific Northwest. And as Ryan specifically said, the kind of that mid-Atlantic corridor also seems to be ripe.
Brainstorming a bit too, you know, and I'm sitting in the studio here looking at my computer screen. I've got to tell you too, John, it kind of reinforces for me something that multiple people have said to me over the years when I'm writing stories about market size. Atlanta had a team, but Cincinnati, again, Orlando, Kansas City, these are all great sports markets.
And by the way, Kansas City, Orlando have always been on potential list for NHL expansion.
And I've quizzed you before as a Cleveland native, like, why the heck does Cleveland not have an NHL team? The answer to that, I believe, is because they have an NBA team, right? And they're going to get one or the other.
Well, you just don't have the corporate base to, you know, it would dilute the corporate base. It would dilute the season ticket base. So a market of that size and even larger can only really afford one quote-unquote winner-based team.
Yeah, got to make a choice, and the market tends to make the choice.
That's right. Well, it was great to get Ryan Creelan on here. Again, the East Coast Hockey League, actually the ECHL, as we were corrected. Great things they're doing, building the game, providing family, affordable entertainment, and hopefully generating a whole new generation of hockey fans.
Yeah, and I really enjoyed talking with Ryan. John, thank you for reaching out and bringing him on. And looking forward to a lot more hockey talk coming up, along with football and, well, lots of winter sports.
That's right. So so thanks for listening to Skin in the Game. And please join us over the next few weeks as we have a few more really exciting programs scheduled.
See you soon, everybody.
This is a production of Buffalo Toronto Public Media. Thanks for listening.